identified certain areas in Eretz Yisrael. Some of them having to deal specifically with the problem of what? Right. Whether we should read the Megillah two nights, 2 days in those places over there. Okay. Now, since we're already talking about the Daria, right? So Amar Rava. So Rava goes back again. He says, Mi'ikol amandu amarakos lav tveria hi. Is there anybody who disputes the fact that Rakas is really Tveria, not Hamas, the way Rabbi Yochanan said? Obviously, he's in disagreement. But he says, I'll show you why I say that it is. The Hawk. We have the following incident related. It says, Kishachiv Inish Hocha, when a great person, Talmud Chacham, right, passed away here, and by here, of course, he means in Babylonia. Okay, so Hosam Zavte Lehochi. So when they brought the body to Eretz Yisrael, so they gave a hesped for this person particularly, right, in the following May. In other words, these are the words that they used. They said, Godol hu b'sheshach, he was a great man in Sheshach, b'shem lo barakas. And he had also a great name in Rakas. Okay, so we have to explain first of all what is Sheshach. The name occurs actually in the book of Yirmiyahu, and they say that there the explanation is that Sheshach is a nickname that Yirmiyahu gave for Babel. Now, how do they figure that out?
Sounds like Persian,
right? The answer is right. That we have, you know, we have Aleph Beis, right? You're familiar with that. Go in order from Aleph Beis, Gimel Daled, etc., from Aleph to Tav, right? We also have, for example, Piyutim and so on, which are written what? They start with Tav, right? And then the next one is a Shin, and then a Resh, and a Kuf, and so on, going what? And then they have what they call Atbash. What's Atbash? It means that Aleph and Tav.
Basis.
Right, they are interchanged, so to speak, right? And the bash is bays and shin. In other words, that's how they pair them off, all right? So that we have, so that in other words, if we would apply that system to sheshach, so sin shin shin becomes bays bays, and the chof of mamet, okay? So that's how we get bavel out of it. As I say, the name occurs in Yirmiyahu. But everybody interprets it to mean that he made this up in order to refer to Babylonia. Okay, so in other words, this person who was brought for burial to Eretz Yisrael, right? He was a great person in Babylonia, and also he had a great name when they brought him to Rakas in order to bury him over there. Now, again, if you've been to Tveria, you know that in the region of Tveria, some of the great chachamim are buried. Okay, probably the most famous, you know, is Rav Meir Balanes. But actually, the Rambam is also buried.
Rambam and Rabbi Akiva.
Rabbi Akiva. Okay, so you have, you know, the great members of
Of Ami Asi Shlo Hakadosh, etc.
Yeah, right. Okay, there's no question. They prefer the grounds of Tveria for burial purposes. Okay, and frankly, if you just go up the hill and so on, eventually you're going to hit Meron also, where. Yeah. Shimon Ben Yochai, yes, it's not that far from the area.
Quite a few more.
You have to climb up the mountain in order to get there.
Quite a few more in the caves.
Yes. So, that being the case, obviously people in Bavel, when they passed away, they wanted to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Okay? I do want to tell you that there's Gemara, which criticizes the people of Babylonia, that they want to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. The question is, you know, why didn't they come to Eretz Yisrael to begin with and live in Eretz Yisrael? Why did they have to come here only as dead people to be buried over here? And of course, you know, you can say the same
persecution.
Well, whatever it was, yes. But as I'm telling you,
the Roman is Greek persecution, not the Roman.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, to continue over here. All right. The chi maske arod alahasam, and then when the Orem, you know, the coffin reached there, in other words, of Israel, and Safti Lehochi. Then they gave the following hesped over him. They said, O Hadei Seridim, O ye who are lovers of the remnant of Israel. You know, we speak about She'eris Israel, right? Or Lulei Hashem Tzvois, the Pasuk in Yeshayo, Lulei Hashem Tzvois. He speaks over there about, actually it's in the second, it's in the chapter 6, right after Kadosh, 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 so then he speaks over there that, you know, the people of Israel are left, you know, like a remnant or something like that, okay? So, in other words, that over here, the Yadei Sevidim refers to the fact that, in other words, we mean fellow Jews, right? Yoshvei Rakas, ye who live in Rakas, again, what do we say Rakas? Tveria, right? Tzu'u v'kablu harugei omek, go out and welcome those who died in the valley. Now, of course, omek, the valley, or emek, as we would say, this refers to Babylonia, because if you're familiar again with the geography of the Near East, you know, Eretz Israel is high, particularly over here, right? But Babylonia is in the valley, lying between two great rivers. One is the Tigris and the other one is the Euphrates, right? Or as we call it, you know, Pras and Chidekel in Hebrew. Okay? This is the Hebrew name that we find in Bereshit for these places, okay? And of course, Pras is also called many times in the Kulish. It's called Hanahar Hagodol Nahar Pras, right? The great river. River Pras. Okay. So it's a very low land, flat land.
A lot of marshlands.
Marshes, correct. But also, they built a tremendous amount of canals to carry water, irrigation water, to the various areas over there. So that was very, very fertile. And we know that many, maybe the majority of the Jewish community in Babel were engaged in agriculture. So, therefore, I mean, we realize, you know, that it's lowland. That's why it's called over here the Omek, in other words, the valley area, as compared to Eretz Yisrael. And now they give an example. Kinoch Davshe de Rabbi Zera, when Rabbi Zera passed away, so Posach Alei Hahu Savdora, then the person who gave the hesped for him said the following things. He says, Eretz Shinar, Horavi Elodo, the land of Shinar, which is part of Babylonia, okay, gave birth, actually conceived, you know, Hora means became pregnant or conceived, right, the Elodah, and gave birth unto this man, right, but Eretz Tzvi, Yidlo Shau Shurecha, but the Eretz Tzvi, meaning Eretz Yisrael, come back to that phrase in a moment, okay, it raised its darlings, okay. First of all, what is Eretz Tzvi? We have the expression actually in Sefer Yecheskel. So, what does it mean, Eretz Tzvi? The answer is that in Aramaic, and therefore also in the Ivrit, you know, that Yecheskel was familiar with, Tzvi means, it's like a synonym for the word Ratzon, okay? In other words, to desire, okay? To love, to desire, this is what the word means. Okay, so this is Eretz Tzvi, in other words, the land which we desire. Okay, don't forget, I mean, Yechezkel was a prophet in Babylonia, but, you know, eventually he prophesied for the return to Eretz Israel. And some of the most stirring chapters, and so that thing that we find in the Tanakh about that. So this is what it is. However, our sages come along and they gave a drash. What do they mean by Eretz Tzvi? They say, Tzvi, a deer, says, if you were to flay it, you know, just separate the skin, you would discover that in reality it could take in a lot more than during the time that it was still on top of the animal. Okay? And they say, this is a bushel, that when people think that Eretz Yisrael cannot take in people, Eretz Yisrael can take in loads and loads of people. Yes, right. That's possible. Look, I still remember, you know, the role. I'm a little bit odd in years, you know. I still remember that the British government issued white papers prior to the Second World War, in which they said, stop the immigration of Jews to Eretz Israel. There is simply no more room for a Jew in Eretz Israel. And this became the official policy of the British government. As you know, they refused to let refugees into Eretz Israel. We still remember the whole business, you know, about how they set up the concentration camp in Cyprus. But also they had other places, too, that they shipped. They
stopped the boats and whatnot.
Yes, they stopped the boats. And, of course, a horrible business, you know. England was working against the Jewish people. So the point that I want to make is, part of the Taina was that there's no room for Jews in Eretz Israel. On the contrary, if it's Eretz Tzvi, then it means, you know, that there's plenty of room for Jews, and we still need more Jews in Eretz Israel. No question about it. Yes, David.
Your commission, their white paper, they said there's not enough room to swing a cap.
Yeah. Okay.
Alright.
Yeah, right. So I don't have to tell you. It was motivated by anti-Semitism and pro-Arabism.
Well,
right. And this is how many years ago? Before the Second World War. Yeah. Okay.
About
29 or something like that.
Right after the First World War.
I'm saying the white paper was left over.
It wasn't even their country. They just had a mandate to administer.
That's correct. Right.
Like the
all right, so getting back to our text then. All right, the land of Shinar is gave birth unto Rabbi Zeira, right? The land of the Eretz Tzvi, Eretz Yisrael, raised its darling, Shal Shu'eha. Oy no la omer rakas, woe unto us, says Rakas, ki avdok lichem dosa, because we have lost our precious kli, you know. If you translate the word
vessel,
Kli
vessel.
Has all kinds, yeah, the one to our precious vessel,
yeah.
But it doesn't do justice.
No.
What it means is that we have lost our precious jewel. Is really what it means. Kli have done. Sometimes you can't translate a word exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the same Kli is the same word that he asked me earlier, what is Klesman? It's the same word. But, you know, we have, for example, the last Mishnah in the entire Mishnayos says, "Loi batzar Kodesh Baruch Hu kli masik tovu liyisrael." The Rebbeinu Shleilim did not find a vessel that contained so much bracha for the people of Israel, Ella Hashalom, except for peace. Shenevar Hashemus liyabiyutei l'shemus abuvashalom. That God will give strength to His people. God will bless His people with peace. So this is kli masik tovu, right? So you can take it in whatever sense it is. Sometimes we find in Gemara, for example, that they know what the word Kela means. Kela means clothing, believe it or not, times. And of course, you know, clay bias, this could mean whatever you need around the house, whatever you need over there, right?
Instruments.
Furniture and so on, that's clay bias, you understand? This is also clay bias, right? Clay mito. What a clay mito. Bedding, exactly. Bedding, right. So you have the word kli used in all kinds of ways. Okay, so kli chandasa, as I say, in my opinion, what it really means is it's precious jewel. Okay. And why? Because Rabbi Zeira was born in Babylonia, but then he studied in Eretz Yisrael and became one of the preeminent scholars in Eretz Yisrael. This is what it means. Gidlo shashu'eha, right? That Eretz Yisrael raised its beloved, its darling. Okay. Shar Shu'eho, of course, reminds us of what? Reminds us of what Yirmiyahu had to say. Habein Yakeli Ephraim, right? Isn't Ephraim my beloved son, right? And Yelet Shar Shu'im, the child with whom I delight to play. In other words, a darling child, right? And I guess all of us, as parents, as grandparents, even as great grandparents, we find children with whom we delight to play, and they are our Yaldei Shashu.
That's
okay.
That's in the Dominion.
Oh, yeah, right.
The cantors.
Yeah, of course.
The choir,
yeah, right. Yeah, because this is one of the verses that is quoted, if you remember, as part of the Zichrodos in the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah. Right. Okay, to continue. All right. So now, inasmuch as we have now identified that Rakas is to vary according to most, in spite of what Rabbi Yochanan had to say. All right. So now along comes Rover, and he says, okay, we've identified Rakas as being what? As being Tveria, right? So what do we do with Chamos? So he says, Chamos, Chamegror. He says, we have another place in Eretz Yisrael where we have hot springs, and that is the hot springs of Gror. So, yeah. So, yeah. And Rakas, he says, Zutaveri, there's no question, all right? And then Kinneres, we said Zuganosar, right? We identify Kinneres with the area which is also called Ginosar. And the Laman Nikro Shma Rakas. So the question is, so why did they call this area also Rakas? So it gives a different reason. It says, Sha'afil Reikonim Shebo Meleim Mitzvahs Kerima. It says, even the sinners, literally those who are empty of mitzvahs, in other words, who live in this area, are still full of mitzvahs, even like a pomegranate. So this is why it's called Tveria. Okay.
Where is this called?
It's called Rakas. Rakas, he identifies with rake or rakot. Okay, people who are empty and still they have loads of mitzvahs. Okay. And of course, we say this in general about the Jewish people, that even if they're not religious, and yet there are many, many good qualities in people who are not religious as well, because they still perform mitzvahs. Okay. Rabbi Yirmiyahu Amar, he said, Rakas, he gave a different version of why it's called Rakas. He says, Rakas Shema, he says, Taken Tveria is called Rakas. But he says, why is it called Tveria? Of course, I had explained to you already several weeks in a row that Tveria really is named after Tiberius Caesar, right? Because the city was built in order to honor Tiberius, who was the second emperor of Rome. He followed Augustus, okay. But when we start in to make a drash, so we find a drash. He says, you know why it's called Tveria? He says, Yosheves Tiburo Shalos Yisrael. Tveria is located on the belly button of Eretz Yisrael. In other words, one of the high central areas of Eretz Yisrael.
But right. If that's the case, this takes away the whole argument that there was a border on it since Yeshua already.
No, okay.
But it may have been born and then it was still done.
Remember that some of these names came at a later period.
I know.
Okay, Tveria certainly. Caesarea is another one, okay, because there's no question about that, that was named, again, was named for Augustus Caesar in this particular case, okay. Maybe for Jews, I don't think it was named for Jews, it was named for Augustus, because Augustus became the emperor of the entire Roman Empire, right. Okay, so, next. Rava Omar, Rakashima, right. Because if one is Rava, then the other has to be Rabba. So take your pick. According to the marginal note. One says Rabba, the other says marginal note, Rava.
The other one is reversed.
Right. So take your pick. It's either Rabba or Rava who said it. Okay. The other one says, okay, why is it called Rakas? And why is it also called Tveria? Right? He says, Shetova Riyasa. He says, Tveria is like. The word Tav in Aramaic is like Tov in Hebrew. In other words, good. And Riyasa, is the ability to see. In other words, you have a tremendous view of the area from Tveria.
Of the mountains from there.
The mountains, it's all right. And frankly, if you go into Tveria, the old city is on the shores of Kinneret. But there's a big mountain that you go up, and once you go up over there, you really have a tremendous view of the entire surrounding area over there.
This is not, it's not good to look at and good to see from, is what you're saying.
Either one, right. Either it's good to see from, right, or look, you can be versatile and say that people who are around, they see a beautiful city over there.
Grammatically, okay.
But I think that the first interpretation is probably the more correct one. Yeah. Right. Okay. Now to continue. All right. Right. Okay. Omar Zahira. So Zahira came and he said, you know, there's another place that's mentioned, Yehoshua, and he says, that's Kitron. You know what Kitron says? He says, Zut Zipori. This is to be identified with Zipori. Before we said, you know, Zipori gave a different identification. Now he identifies it with Kitron. It says, Veloma Nikro Shmo Zipori. And why do they call it Zipori? So he says, Sheyoshevas Barosha Hor, because it is located on the top of a mountain. Kitzipor, like a bird, right? So the question is, the Kitron Zipori, you want to tell me that Kitron is Zipori? Oh, Kitron, didn't the Kitron belong to Chelkol Shel Zebulun Havai, that belonged to the portion which is assigned to Shevet Zebulun? Dichsiv, as it is written, Zebulun lo harishas Yoshvei Kitron, that the people of Zebulun, when they conquered the land, they did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron. Yes, Yoshvei Nahalal, nor the inhabitants of the Halal, right? So, in that particular case, where is Zebulun located? The answer is, Zebulun is located on the Mediterranean. Located on the Mediterranean, okay? How do we know that? Because another passage in the Torah says, Zebulun nechof yamim yishko, right? In other words, that Zebulun lives on the seashore. And, you know, therefore the people of Zebulun were famous, you know, for shipping. Right? Yeah. Huh? Yeah, right. Okay, that's already a different thing, because Yisachar is located in the Avik Valley, okay? And Zebulun is on the coast, okay? And of course, we say that the Yisachar devoted themselves to learning, and Zebulun devoted themselves to business. And, right, and they made a compact between them that the people in Yisachar would do the learning for the people in Zvolun, and the people in Zvolun would do the business in order to support the people in Yisachar. I don't know whether this is true of the average congregation today, where they say, Rabbi, you perform the mitzvahs, and we'll provide financial support or not. Okay, but at any rate, Kitron, definitely from this pasuk then, would show us that where was it located and where Shevet Zebulun is. Because they're right, as we say, you know, that the people of Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of the Kitron, nor the inhabitants of the Halal. And since we're talking about Zebulun, so we see something else that comes up. It says, Zebulun is swaying on me, they serve Hava. Zebulun complained about the area which is given to it. Midos over here, you know, usually Mitzvah Midos means that you complain about somebody's character or something like that. But here I think Midos actually comes from the essential word that means to measure. In other words, the area that was measured to be its tribe. They didn't like it. They felt that they were being discriminated against. Okay? Right. Shenemar. As the Pasuk says, of course, this is a Pasuk taken from Shiras Devorah that we find in the book of Shoftim. It says, Zebulun amchev nafsho lamus. Okay. Now, if you would take a look in the Herz Chumash or in any English translation of the Bible, this is a compliment to Zebulun. They say what? That Zebulun was willing to sacrifice its life in order to fight on behalf of the people of Israel. Okay? That's what it means. To save the people of Israel. They fought in the battle against the Canaanites. Okay? Sisera and the Canaanites. Okay. So they were willing to sacrifice their lives in battle in order to defend the people of Israel. Okay? This is how we translate it. But, as I say, when it comes to our drash, you find that people will sort of twist around the meaning in order to bring out another one. Alright, so a moment ago we said that Zebulun was dissatisfied with the territory assigned to him, and this is the pasuk. So how do you get it? So the answer is cheref nafsho. You have to connect it with the same root letters. We have the word cherpa. What's a cherpa? Shame or something like that, right? We get Yiddish, you say achapa dashada, you know. Okay. Right. So in other words, Zebulun felt ashamed of what was given to him. He was not happy. Okay? Ma tam, what is the reason? Mishum de Naftali Amarome Soda. Because as we go on in the Shiras Devorah, we find that, you know, Devorah sings and Naftali lives in the high places of the field. In other words, so Omar Zvulun, Theokodish Baruch. So Zvulun complained to the Rebbeinu Shalom. He said, Rebbeinu Shalom, he says, Le'achai Nusatalem Soda Sechromim. To my brethren, in other words, meaning to the people of Naftali, right? You gave fields, vineyards, right? In other words, the high areas that you assigned to them. This is excellent for growing grapes and raising other kinds of plants, right? The lina satahor megros, and to me, what did you give me? You gave me mountains, obviously mountains that are not good, you know, for agriculture, or gvois, or valleys again, which are not good. Not only that, but the achai nesatahem arotzes. You gave them real land. The lina sata yavim nahoris. You know what you gave me? You gave me seas and rivers. In other words, a good deal of my territory is wet territory. I don't have enough land. So Amaloi, so the Rebbeinu Shalom said, Kulan Sarichin Lecha Al Yedei Chikozein. He said to Zebulun, he says, you know, every Jew is going to need you. And you know why? Because you, on your shores, we have the chilazon. Now, what is the chilazon? The answer is it's a kind of a snail, which when you crushed it, you got the purple dye. And naturally, what was the dye used for? It was used for the tzitzis. Because it's written, you know, Yosalem tzitzis hakono pasil techeles, right? But you have to put a thread of techeles over there. So what was the dye that was used for the techeles? So the answer is that it came from these shellfish that grew over there. It's a special species, you know. If you would take the average shellfish, you're not going to get a blue dye out of it, okay? But this was a very special one. And therefore, we find that everybody needed it for their tzitzis. Shenemar usfunei tumunei choyl. And then we have the pasuk which says, and ships that will be filled with, literally with sand. So to me, Rav Yosef, so what kind of a bargain is this to have ships filled with sand? So he says, so Rav Yosef gave the following interpretation. He says, Sfune, says, you know what that word means? That means chilozon. It means, first of all, that the woman is going to have the chilozon. And to Mune, you know what that is? He says, this is Zut Oris. He says, those are sardines. Of course, we see sardines in, you know, packed in olive oil and cans or something like that, right? But the sardine can also grow a little bit bigger than what we see inside the can, as you know. Okay. Yeah, it could grow. And, you know, in other words, you had a load of fish over there in the Mediterranean, and you were able to get this fish so that it supplied food. Not just for the people in Zebulun, but also it gave them business, you see, that they could sell the fish to the other tribes as well, okay? So far they had the chilazon, the dye, coming out of the chilazon, they had the sardines, and finally, Arbat Chol, sand. So he says, Chol, he says, Zuzachachasavona, he says, this is literally white glass. In other words, from this special sand, they were able to make a very high quality of glass. And of course, we found vases and stuff like that, you know, that go way, way back, you know, thousands of years. Yes. Sifun? No, this is Sifune. It comes from the word Sfina. It's related to that word. Right, yes, related to the word Sfina, you know, boat. Yeah. Okay, so Omar Lefonov, so the woman is still not finished with his conversation with the Rebbeinu Shalom, okay? He says, Rebbeinu Shalom, me Modiyeni, who is going to let me know that I'm going to have all these things? So Omar Lefonov, Rebbeinu Shalom said, it's written, Shom Yizbechu Zivchei Tzedek, that there they will sacrifice sacrifices of righteousness. Simon ze yehelecho call. Simon ze yehelecho. This is a sign that you will have. Call hanotil mimcha b'leidomim. If anybody takes things from you without paying the money for it, ein amoyel b'pragmatia shelo klom, then he will never succeed in his own business. So in other words, you know that you'll be making a good living from everybody, because if people refuse to pay you the proper price, you know, for the things that you produce, and in that particular case, their own businesses will fail eventually. Okay? The Yisal Kodateich, and if you think Kitron Zutzipori, that Kitron is Zipori, am I misreading only this of? So why should Zebulun complain? It's a different area altogether, right? The Hohavi Zipori, Milzada Difa Tuva. So they say, yeah, but Zipori actually is a better thing. Why? The chitemo, the lesbos of Ascholot, and if you say that in the land of Eretz Israel there isn't, you know, land flowing with milk and honey, Omar Reish Lakish, didn't Reish Lakish say, Lididi, I myself, he says, Chazili, I saw, he says, Zovas Cholavad Vash Tzipori. Right. I saw that the literal fulfillment of flowing with milk and honey happened in Tzipori. And remember, you know, Tzipori is that's the reason why Tzipori is so important, he says, right? And he says, you know what? The Havia Shisha Osam Mil al Shisha Osam Mil. And you know, this territory around Tzipori, which was flowing with milk and honey, he says, was 16 miles by 16 miles. Now, of course, again, the mile, those days actually refers to a Roman mile, which was roughly about 5,000 feet in American. All right, so then, anyway, it's a considerable area, right? The chi temor de lo nefisho didei kedachuha, and if you say that he didn't have as much as his brethren, the Omer Rabbi Barachone, didn't Rabbi Barachone say, Omer Rabbi Yochan, the name of Rabbi Yochan, he said, Lididei chazili zavos cholzut v'ash techol aret Yisrael. I saw the entire area in Eretz Yisrael that was flowing with milk and honey, v'havia kimibei kubei at akra, and it was, the entire area was like the distance between Beikube to Akra. So of course the question is, where is Beikube and where is Akra? We learned towards the end of Kedushin, where they identify certain spots in Babylonia. Babylonia was big, you know, they had different things. So these are two areas that are mentioned over there in Gemara Kedushin as being in different parts of Babylonia. And since he figured, you know, that if he's talking to scholars of Babylonia, so he wants to give them something that they could understand, you know, rather than in terms of the Roman mile, because in Babylonia they did not use the mile. They used instead what? They used instead the measurement that we call parsa, or parasite, which was, you know, a Persian measure. I mean, don't forget that Babylonia had been conquered by Persia, and so therefore you're going to find a lot of Persian words in Babel, okay? And this is one of them. The word parasaing, I still remember from my study in Greek. It's one of the first words that you learned when you studied Xenophon.
What?
Xenophon. Xenophon is a Greek historian who lived in the days of Cyrus, incidentally. And then he wrote about the fact that you know, after the death of Cyrus, Cyrus was assassinated, incidentally. So the Greek mercenaries that he had hired decided that it's time to go back to Greece, and there was a long, long march that they had to do, you know, from the middle of the Persian Empire and get all the way up to you know, to the Black Sea or something like that, in order to be able, you know, to finally get to an area from which they can get to Greece, okay? And he describes the march, you know, like we have this coming week, Matas and Masse. We will be reading, right, he went from, you know, we left this place, and we came to this place, and went from this place. And this is a good deal of what the Xenophon's Anabasis is. And he always says, and it's so many parasangs that, that we traveled and so on and so on. So
this Pasan is still used some once in a while for distance.
What?
Pasan.
Parsa? Yeah, because it's a, you know, and the Gemara uses parsa.
Yeah, even right. in literatures, in the older book is mentioned.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you know, they simply adopted it, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So he says the distance. That you know the distance between Beikubi and Akra, this is the distance of that. Beakra de Kubi, okay, excuse me, I should have said the next word, because Akra itself is really a Greek word that became part of their vocabulary, okay? Akra in Greek means high. And of course, what is the most famous spot in Athens?
The Acropolis,
which means literally the high town, the high city. You understand? That's really what it means. Because it was raised on the heights over there, overlooking the city of Athens. Okay? So it became synonymous with also building fortifications. Because obviously, if you build a fortification on high, you could, you could see the area all around and so on, see if invading armies were coming. So this was the Akra de Tulbanka. As I say, that's the way I should have read it. Okay? And he says, you know what the distance was? And he says, it's Esrin the Tartan Parse Urka Fusio Shisa Parse. It says, it's 22 parses in length and its width is 6 parses. Okay? In other words, this is a big distance because the parsa is much longer than the mil.
This would be the size of the
mil.
Four mil. Earlier, the size of Zebulun, what they're describing.
Well, really, we're talking about Zebulun, but we'll forget about Zebulun for the moment. It's complaining about, you know, Tzipori. Why is Tzipori? So he says Tzipori because you can see all around. And, you know, he says Tzipori had the Bila that. From there you could see Eretz Zovas Cholovid Vash. And it takes in all this area, you know, that's Eretz Zovas Cholovid Vash. That's what he's saying. Right, okay. We're talking in praise of, you know, various places in Eretz Israel, including Tzipori, which incidentally you have a chance to visit, you should visit Eretz Israel, okay? So he says, Afilo Hochi, yeah, even so, even though we've been praising Tzipori and that's a land of, you know, Eretz Zovas Cholovid Vash. So nevertheless, the woman is still complaining, and he says, what? Sodos Uchromim Adifale. I still would prefer to have what? A land where I can have fields and vineyards. Okay? To me, that's more important. Daikaname. And it says, okay, examine the text very carefully. Dixir, because it's written over there, Venaftoli Almerome Soda. That Naphtali was on the heights of the field, so Shema Aminah. Okay, and that proves what? That according to Zebulun, who had the better deal?
Naphtali.
Okay. So that's why Zebulun was poaching. Even though Rabbi Shalom told him, look, all the Jews are going to need you, they're going to need your kibazon, they're going to need your sand, they're going to need the sardines that come, you know, that you go fishing for, and so on and so forth. But nevertheless, he had a gripe. So, wipe that gripe. Okay, yes.
Naphtali don't have the area around the
Kinneret?
Which? Naphtali.
Yes. The area around the Kinneret, correct.
But that's not a high field.
Okay. Well, you do have, I mean, going up from Kinneret, you have high mountains over there. Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, to go from Tver to Lavi, you know, you have to go climbing high.
Right. Okay, I see.
Okay, we'll stop another moment. Omar Rabbi Abo, Rabbi Abo said, okay, you know, we have a pasuk in Zephaniah, and he says over there, the Ekron Teoker, and Ekron will be uprooted. Now, we know that Ekron, in the days of the you know, the days of the Bible, I'm thinking of the book of Shoftim, you know, not Parsha Shoftim, but the book of Shoftim, the book of Judges. Okay, you have the story, of course, of Samson, right? And there were five outstanding Philistine cities. Aza was one, Ekron was another, and so on. Okay,
but they all down the south.
Most of them are down there. Ashkelon is another one, right? Okay, so most of them in the south, but over here, Rabbi Abahu identifies Ekron apparently with a much more northerly city, because he says Zu Kesari Bas Edom. This is Kesaria, literally the daughter of Edom. And don't forget that the time in the Talmud they identified Edom with Rome. In other words, this is Caesarea, which is the Roman city. Actually, it was the capital of the Roman province for many, many years. Okay? Shehi Yosheves Ben Acholos, which literally dwells among the sands. In other words, you know, if you've been to Caesarea, you know that it's right on the seashore. And of course, you have sand over there. Right. And he says, this city was like a peg that was stuck into Israel. In other words, like a needle in the flesh of Israel, so to speak, right? In the days of the Greeks. And then when the kingdom of the Hasmoneans became strong, they conquered the Greeks. In other words, they conquered, of course, the city of Ekron. They conquered the area which became Caesarea, but was Ekron, according to him, right? According to Rav Bohu, right? So, Hoyakor and Oysa, they called it Achidas Migdal, which means Achidas Migdal Shir. This was Migdal Shir, literally the Tower of Song, which was Achidas. Achidas over here is like the word Achuz, in other words, seized from the Greeks. Okay? Yes? The answer is simple, that he wasn't interested in the geography as such. He could have been in Eretz Yisrael, he could have been in Babylonia, but he wanted to give some identification to this posuk, which says we Ekron Teoker. And then said, you know this, Ekron, Ayin Kuf Resh, is related, you know, according to his drash, with the word which means the Heyoker, which means to be uprooted. Okay? So that he wanted to give it, he says, what should be uprooted? This is the idea. What should be uprooted? What should be uprooted should be Caesarea shall Edom. In other words, the day will come in Yitzhak Hashem when there will be no more Romans ruling over Eretz Israel, but instead it will be a Jewish land again. And in my opinion over here, maybe they are using the word Yevonim, the Greeks, as a substitute probably for Rome, because, you know, as long as the Roman government was still there, so they said, oh, we're talking about Greeks, we're not talking about you.
But the Greeks were the populations there.
Not necessarily. However, you're right to a certain extent in that. First of all, the Eastern Mediterranean world, linguistically, you had two predominant languages, and of course in Eretz Israel you also had three. Okay, what were they? One of them, of course, in Eretz Israel was Ivrit. Obviously there were Jews who spoke Hebrew, but as we saw, loads of them spoke what? They spoke Arabic. They spoke Aramaic. Okay, but at the same time there was also a huge population which spoke Yevanit. They spoke Greek.
The northern part, the eastern part of the today's Turkey was all Greek.
Yeah, correct. Okay. That's correct, because they took over islands that at one time were Greek. Yeah. And so, you know, you always had, there was a war for centuries as to which would be the language which would dominate. Would it be Aramaic or would it be Greek? So people learn to be fluent in both languages, okay? And of course, if you had to deal with the Roman government, then in that particular case, you also had to learn Latin in order to get along with them. So Jews had to learn to be multilingual, okay? All right, I think I'll stop at this particular point. It's already close to 9 o'clock, and my voice says, Dayenu for tonight. Okay, tonight is, what is it, 25th today already?
25th.
Yeah. 25th of July, I think. Yeah.
In the year 2001, I hope.
Mashiach should come already.
We'll go back to Jewish calendars.
Okay, at any rate, we are continuing now in Megillah, Dabov, Amud Aleph, and just want to... learning a little bit about the geography of Eretz Yisrael, where they identified places which are mentioned in the Sefer Yehoshua, in the book of Yehoshua, right, with some of the places that they were more familiar with at the time of the Talmud, okay? And this is part of the reason why, for example, when it came to Tiberia, they were not sure whether it was Rakas, whether it was Hamas, you know, so... because, you know, Tiberias, I told you, had been built in reality, you know, in the days when Tiberius Caesar was the emperor of Rome, the successor to Augustus, whereas, you know, there were obviously older settlements once upon a time, so they were trying to identify it. Now, of course, the question is, why did they get involved in the first place? So, as we saw, the basic reason was because they wanted to try to identify places that had a wall. This is the idea, right? So that in such a place, as we learned, so they would read the Megillah on the 15th, on Tesvav, on the 15th of Adar, instead of reading it on the 14th. All right, so now we continue. And here we're going to have several statements, you know, which are based, first of all, upon interpretations, as we would say, a drash by Rabbi Yitzchak, plus others as well, but particularly Rabbi Yitzchak, we have different statements over here. Okay. So, first of all, by the way, I want to show you where we are right now, okay? If you take a look at your text, okay, I'm going to start again from the ending. You see where it says, Shoftim Hei? Then the next line says, Tzafanya. Do you see that? And the margin. Down in the margin, where they give the sources of the quotations over here. Okay, you see the little letters over there? First it says Shoftim Hei, and then it says Tzafanya Beis. Okay? All right. In this particular case, now they want to make a drash about what is the meaning of a verse which in itself is not very, very clear to us what it means. I don't have to tell you that not always do we understand the Lashon of the Nevi'im. At times they can be very difficult, right? And at the same time, of course, there are other passages too in the Torah Kedusha that you know that they're not always easy to understand. The pasuk over there says the Ekron Teyoker. Ekron, by the way, we had that previously, but now he gives a new drash for it, right? The Ekron Teyoker. He says that Ekron is going to be uprooted. This is what Teyoker means. Okay. So he says, you know what they're talking about? He says Zu Kesari Bas Edom. Says this is Caesarea, literally the daughter of Edom. In other words, this is Caesarea in the land of Edom, or the people of Edom, Shehi Yosheves Ben Acholos, which literally dwells among the sands. Okay, we'll continue in a moment, but first I have to explain what is the Indian about Edom over here. So the answer is, of course, that to our Chachomim, Edom or Esav, you know, remember that they're synonyms for each other, right? They identify Edom with Rome. So first of all, when they identify it with Rome, they were talking about Imperial Rome, the Rome that they knew for several centuries, right? The Rome of Augustus Caesar and Tiberius, and later on, you know, the Rome that continued through the various Roman empires. And then, of course, in the later period, what did Rome symbolize? Symbolized already Christianity, from which the Jews suffered, particularly beginning roughly about the 3rd, 4th century, so in Eretz Israel, and this was one of the major problems. So In other words, Edom was identified with what? With Rome. David?
Caesarea was named for whom? Augustus?
Which
Caesar? Caesarea. Caesarea.
Oh, Caesarea?
Augustus?
Yeah, probably named for Augustus, right. Because that already, again, was an older place. But, you know, successively they built upon it. And when the Romans built Caesarea, they built it specifically that it should serve as the center of Roman government in Eretz Israel. This is why, you know, you have the amphitheater over there, and so on, okay? And we'll see a quotation over here which refers to these institutions of the Romans, okay? All right. So, it says that, first of all, it dwells among the sands. Well, those of us who have been to Eretz Israel and have seen Caesarea, we know that it's right on the seashore over there, and doctor, it's sand all around it, okay? But by the way, you know, you have, besides the amphitheater that they have over there, you may remember there's also an aqueduct that leads,
right,
that the Romans built.
Right.
And of course, I've had a chance to see aqueducts in other parts of the world, particularly when I was in France, where I saw a very, very famous one over there, the Pont du Gard, where you can still drive a car over the bridge. I assume it's only a small European car. I don't know about SUV or not, but let me take it. But it shows, you know, this is one of the one of the gifts that the Romans had, that they knew how to build very well. There's no question about that. And, you know, the whole business of you know, using the arch in order to be able to support tremendous weights. This was a great contribution on the part of Roman architecture. Okay. So, there is Caesarea, and he identifies it as Caesarea of Edom, which doesn't mean, as we said a moment ago, it does not mean the land of Edom, which was east of the Jordan River, but he means built by the Romans. Okay. And what does he have to say about it? He says, "V'hiyo Yisrael yosei tekul Yisrael." Okay. And this was like a peg which was stuck into Israel. Now what he means is, you know, we've talked about a pinprick, right? But, you know, this is stronger than a pinprick. It was like a nail driven in into the heart of Israel, in other words, to show that the Romans, they oppressed the people of Israel, and there was Caesarea where the Roman governor was situated, right? And it was like a peg, always sticking it, you know, to the Jews in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Now, the genealogy over here, I mean the chronology here to me is a little bit uncertain. Okay. Why? Because they say, when was it? He says, "Bimeyavodim," in the days of the Greeks. And then he says, "Ushegover Malchus Beis Chashmonai," and then when the kingdom of the Chashmonaim, you know, became strong with Nitzchum, and they conquered the Greeks who were living over there. So here called Noesor Achidas Bidalshir. So they called it the conquered, or the seized, literally, like the Hebrew word Lechos, the seized. All right, the conquered Bidalshir. That's what they called it. Okay, so guns fine. All right. I say, the chronology to me is a little bit funny, simply because in the final analysis, Caesarea was really identified with Rome rather than with Greek. You know, at an earlier period during the time of the Hashmonaim, you know, when you had, Antiochus Epiphanes, and prior to that, you know, you had the Ptolemaic Greeks, you know, from Egypt who ruled over there. So, yeah.
On point. You said that Edom was to the east of the Jordan River, where Moab would be. I always thought that Edom was where Mala Adonim was, and that was not Edom at all?
No. Mala Adonim is actually built where Yehuda is. It's already the tribe of Yehuda, okay? Remember that, geographically, Yerushalayim straddled the line, so to speak, between Binyamin and Yehuda.
Right.
So that anything south of that line was Shevet Yehuda, including all the caves that you find over there, along the Dead Sea, and so on and so on. This was territory that belonged to Shevet Yehuda. Okay? to the north, of course, you had Binyamin, first of all. For example, Anatot, which is the place where Yirmiyahu lived. Today, they call it Anata, and it's become, on the Loyolino, it's become an Arab town, okay? So all that territory over there, you know, which like Pisgat Ze'ev, and so, in other words, anything north of Yerushalayim is really Shevet Binyamin, and then, of course, it continues with. Then you have the territory of Ephraim.
But in yeah. I understand, like, through Hebron is Yehuda, but like Herod, who is an Idumean, supposedly.
Oh,
where did they?
Okay.
I thought that was Edom. I thought that they were south of. But they were on the west of.
No,
the
let me explain. No, they were not west. Edom itself is east, sort of like really east of the Yam HaMelach, okay?
Sure, okay.
Right. Directly opposite, you have, you know, you have, first of all, Moab, right? And then you have, going further down, you have Edom. And then, of course, there were territories that were conquered by the tribes, you know, of Reuven and Chatzi Shevet Menashe, right, and the tribe of God, and so on. That territories that we would call Gilad, for example, that we would call the Golan today. But in those days, you know, they were territories of Israel, and of course, Jordan itself occupies a good deal of that territory today. Okay? So that this is the way the geography is. Now, what you're referring to is the fact that Israel made war in the days of the Hashmonaim. You know, I'm talking now about the dynasty of the Hasmoneans. They made war against Edom, and they conquered it. In doing so, they sort of converted some of the inhabitants. So one of the guys who felt that it was a good idea to convert to Judaism so he could do business was a man by the name of Antipater. Or Antipater, Antipatris, whatever you want to call him, okay? He was the father of Herod, okay? So Herod was a Jew, but I don't have to tell you that as far as his genealogy is concerned, it wasn't that pure as far as it's concerned, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Right. And then, of course, what happened is that Herod married Miriam, who was descended from the Hashmonaim, okay? So that this gave him a claim to legitimacy when he established his throne. In reality, Herod knew how to play the political game very well. He befriended Julius Caesar when Julius Caesar was on top. When Caesar was assassinated, so, if you remember then, the Roman world was divided. The east was taken over by Mark Antony, and the west was taken over by Augustus, okay? So what happened? What happened is that when it was to his advantage to support Mark Antony, he supported him. But when he saw that the battle was going, you know, then remember, there was the war between Augustus and Mark Antony, which in the end wound up as the defeat of Mark Antony and Cleopatra, you know, and he knew how to play the game very well. He befriended Augustus at that time. So this is how he was. But from the point of view of Yiddishkeit, he wasn't the greatest. The one good contribution that he made to Yiddishkeit is that he beautified the Beis HaMikdash. That he did too. Okay? But as far as other things is concerned, he was very much content to establish places for the Romans, circuses, theaters, amphitheaters, etc., etc. Okay? Yeah. Okay, to continue. All right. So, all right. Amar Rabbi Yosef Bar Chanina. So Rabbi Yosef Bar Chanina came with another interpretation. He says, "My dichsiv." What is the meaning of the pasuk? And this is pasuk comes from Zechariah. It says, "Vasirosi dama b'piv," literally, which means I shall remove his blood from his mouth. Of course, remember the picture over here is what, like a bloodthirsty animal, you know, that bites and sucks blood, right? So I will remove the blood from his mouth. V'shikutzo b'bein shinov, and likewise all the. The shikutzim, you know, in other words, everything that's you know, it's obscene, right, from among his teeth. you know, this word shikutz, you know, with you probably recognize the word sheketz, shegetz, etc., etc., right? Okay. And then, benishar gamhu leilahenu, and he will also remain, or be left over for our God. Now, first of all, the pasuk itself is a little bit funny, but we'll see how he interprets it, okay? It says, v'arotzi roisi domo mipiv, he says, and I will remove his blood from his mouth. So he says, Zebes Bamyo, or Bamayo, or something, Bamyo Shavahen, right? So he says, this means that I will remove from his mouth the Beis Bamya. Now the question is only, what is Beis Bamya? And then the next one, Shikutsum and Bein Shinov, this he says, Zebes Galya. So Rashi refers to Bamya and Galya. He says that they were the leading idols of Edom. That's how he interprets it, okay? And that's what it means. Maybe we could find a closer Hebrew parallel, however, to both of these. Bamya could very well be related to the word a bama. What's a bama? Huh? No, that's a behema.
What's
no,
the word again?
Bama.
Bama is a high place.
That's right. It's a high place where they offer sacrifices to the Avodah Zorah. Okay? And Galya. So, Galya has been interpreted as referring to like Gal Avanim. What is Gal Avanim? It's like a heap of stones.
Yeah,
remember, for example, by Yaakov Avinu and his father-in-law, you know, Laban, remember that they made a treaty that they set up Gal Eid, if you remember, like a heap of stones to serve as a witness, that and they made a commitment to each other. I will never go against you by passing this one, and you won't go against me by passing, you know, this way, and so on and so forth. Okay, so again, you know, this is obviously related to the fact that they set up these heap of stones for worship purposes.
That's where you
right.
find Gal not being used as weight, but as a keep.
That's correct. Right. Yeah. I mean, when fine, you know, Eichel be reading the Satyushalim or Yirmiyahu, the Galim. So, what does it mean, the Galim? Obviously, it doesn't mean waves. It means that it'll be, Yerushalayim is going to become like a heap of stones. This is, Yirmiyahu, the Haftorah that we read on Tisha B'Av itself. Okay. So, yeah. All right. So, in other words, what are we saying? How does he interpret this? But he says the pasuk means that they're going to remove all the idols and all the idolatry that was practiced from these places, and what will take the place? The nishar gamhu leloheinu, right? And it shall be left over, or shall remain also for our God. So, how do you explain that? It says, "Elu boti kineisios uvoti midrosho shebe'edom." Okay, he says these are the shuls and the beis midrashes, right, that will be set up in Edom. In other words, the day will come when Yiddishkeit will spread even to that area, and they will set up synagogues. They'll set up bate midrash over there. This is what it's going to be, so that then they too will remain loyal to God at that time. Okay, even over there in Edom. Okay, and then we have another pasuk also in Zechariah, and he's going to interpret it now. He says, "Well, Yor ka'aluf bi'Yehuda, v'yekron ki'Yevusi." All right. So again, the question is, and he shall be like an aluf in Judah. Now the question is, what does the word aluf mean? Well, we normally mean, right, when we talk about Aluf, you know, we think, of course, like Alufei Adom, El Alufei Adom, and so on and so forth. In other words, the chieftains, you're right, or today they make generals out of Aluf, and so on. Right, right. Okay, so this is the way we usually interpret it. However, I've seen another interpretation, which to me makes a great deal of sense, because it's more in line with what we've said just a few moments ago. Le'alef in Hebrew means actually to instruct someone. Right. Yeah, it means to instruct someone, right? From this incident, you have the word like upan, upana, and so on. You know, places of instruction, okay? Yeah, ma'alef, right, right. So it means to instruct. Now, we have another word. You're probably familiar with the root, lulamed. What is lulamed? Also means to teach, to instruct, correct? Okay? Now, we have in Hebrew a word, malbad. Malbad habakar. What is malbad habakar? The answer is that this is what we call like a spur or something like that that you use in order to prod. Prod is the English word for it. It's a prod to get the animal in order to move, right? That's a malbad habakar, okay? So in other words, it's very parallel to what we said before. Namely what? That he's going to be like a prod again, you know, like as we said before, you know, a sticker, a peg, whatever it is, like a nail on the side of Judah, right? And Ekron will become like Yevusi. Now, how does he interpret that? What is Yevus? You were correct. Yevus was the ancient name of Yerushalayim, okay? In the days of King David, they conquered Yevus from the Yevusim, right? In other words, from the people, the Jebusites, we call them in English, right? And they conquered it and they made it into Yerushalayim, okay? So Ekron, which we said before, Ekron Teyaker, in other words, what's going to happen to Ekron? Ekron is going to be uprooted, which means that the Avodah Zorah and so on that we said a moment ago that existed over there is going to be uprooted, and what will happen? It will become like Yerushalayim. That would be one interpretation. However, the Gemara at this point has contrary interpretation altogether. Because he says, you know what it means, Ekron Kiyavusi? Actually, it's not so far from what I said, but we'll see. He says, Elu. Now, here is Taratrios, but in reality it should be like Teatrios. Mm-hmm. Teatrios, in other words, it's the Greek word which means a theater, right? And of course, what does it mean by theater? Actually, if you've been, for example, I had occasion to be in France, in southern France, which at one time was a great center of Roman civilization, okay? So, when I was, for example, in the city of Nîmes, okay, beautiful place, by the way, so you could see not only a tremendous amphitheater, which looks like a small version of the Circus Maximus in Rome, but also they have places like in Arles, which is not so far away from there, you know, it's also southern France. But I saw a theater over there where to this very day they can put on plays. So what is being said over here is the fact that here they were, these teatrios or taratrios and the kirkasois, in other words, this is like, it's really the word kirkas in Latin, right? Of course in English we say circus because, you know, by us, a C before an I has to be pronounced like a S, right? Whereas in Latin, to begin with, it was pronounced like a K. So that's the reason why. Okay, so the theaters and the circuses, in other words, Sheba Edom, he doesn't mean the land of Edom, but he means belonging to what? To Roman civilization, right? Shah Sidin, he says, they are destined, Zore Yehuda Lamed Behem Tor Barabim. The day will come when the Sora Yehuda, literally the princes of Yehuda, by course, he means in this case the great Talmidei Chachamim among the Jewish people, will one day convert these places and use them as places in order to teach Torah. So, what we have over here, in other words, is a picture of two peoples in opposition one to the other, right? On the one hand, we have, of course, the Jews, right? And on the other hand, we have the Goyish world is represented over here by Edom, by Rome, correct? And so what he's saying over here then is that first of all those areas that were like a thorn in the side of the Jewish people, one day we will live to see that they will be converted, and we'll establish shuls, and we'll establish what they medrash over there, and they will learn the Torah of Hashem. Okay, no, I'll invite it to happen. Okay? All right. Then, another interpretation of Rabbi Yitzchak. Okay. There is a place in Sefer Yehoshua by the name of Leshem. Okay? Leshem. So again, as I said, they want to try to identify places with the names that they were more familiar with. So he says, Leshem, he says, Pabyas. This is Pabyas. Now, of course, Pabyas, or since the Arabs can't pronounce a P, they pronounce it a B, so it becomes Pabyas, okay? But of course, those of us who have been to Eretz Yisrael, we know that this is among the most northern parts of Eretz Yisrael. You have a very beautiful park over there today, and there is where we have the beginning of the Jordan River, because there are three different streams that enter over there, and they form the Jordan River. Incidentally, what is the origin of the word? So they say the origin of the Jordan is right, the Greek idol Pan, right? And so that's why they call it Panyas. All right. So it says, Lashem, this is Panyas. Okay. Ekron te Yaker, and the pasuk continues that Ekron is going to be a British. So it says Zu Kesari Basedom, as we've already said previously, but now he gives another business about Kesari. It says Shehi Hoyso Metropolitan Shomalah. He says this was a, and of course you recognize the word metropolitan, a metropolis, right? This was the metropolis of kings. Okay, guns fine. In other words, what? Roman kings had a great deal to do with Caesarea, okay? Well, even if the king wasn't there, but his governor was there, you understand? And the governors also, they represented the authority of Rome. Ikoni Amre, there were those who say, what? Demar Bibo Malchi, that actually the place was a place that was a breeding ground for kings. The Ikoni Amre, and there were those who say, Demut Binun Malchi. Okay, Malchi Kesari. The Mukbeh Mina Malchi. This is where I should put the period over here. It raised kings from its midst. In other words, it could mean maybe that, let's say, natives of Caesarea became emperors later on in Rome, okay, or became high officials in Rome. And the other one says, you know, that when they came over there, this is where they were raised. To become big shots in Rome. All right. Now, the Gemara continues and says, Kesare v'Yerushalayim. Okay. Remember what I said. Rome, Jerusalem. Right? Famous book, by the way, by Moshe Hess, written in the early 19th century, if you remember. Rome and Jerusalem, which became one of the earliest books in the Zionist literature. Okay. Long before Herzl. Okay. And in it, you know, he posed the conflict, so to speak, of two different points of view. One is that of Rome, representative of the Goyish world, and the other, of course, Jerusalem, representative of the Jewish world. So he says, all right, Caesarea or Caesarea and Jerusalem. Im yom alecho odom, if a person should say to you, that both have been destroyed, don't believe it. Yoshvushtehen, both of them are settled and flourishing, is the idea. Don't believe it either, he says. If you tell me Chova Kesari v'Yoshvu Yerushalayim, if you tell me that Kesaria has been laid waste, you know, has become a churban, right, but Yerushalayim remains a beautiful city, settled and so on. So, or just the opposite. Chorvo Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim is destroyed by Yoshua Kesari. Then in that case, Tame, believe it. In other words, the two cannot exist and flourish side by side. Either it has to be a Jewish point of view, as represented by Yerushalayim, or it has to be a Goyish point of view, as represented by Kesaria, as represented by Edom. Okay? Yes, Beverly.
If Adam is symbolizing the world outside of Yisrael,
right,
then how were the people in Germany able to ever reconcile their viewpoint that you're supposed to take the best of the outside world and Yisrael to make it?
Okay, no, I understand what you're saying very, very well. I mean, and this, after all, to a certain extent, is an interpretation of what Samson Raphael Hirsch had to say, okay? For those of you who don't recognize the name, Samson Raphael Hirsch, or Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, is the founder of what we might call modern orthodoxy, so to speak, the founder. In that, he felt that, you know, a Jew had to have a university education and be fully current with the world as it is, at the same time to remain intensely loyal to Yiddishkeit, okay? And of course, you know, from his point of view, I mean, we can understand, because we too are really living in a similar situation over here. We are citizens of the world, we are citizens of the United States. We have not shut ourselves into an isolated ghetto. So we're aware of these things, and at the same time, we have an obligation to live a Jewish life. So the answer is that we have a conflict of loyalties. But hopefully, in this conflict, we're able to work out a synthesis that will enable us to choose the best of both worlds, so to speak, right? And at the same time, to remain loyal to Yiddishkeit. The problem is, of course, when people become so enamored of the non-Jewish world, that you know, they assimilate completely, or they leave us altogether. You see, this is where the problem comes in. Yes.
I have a different question.
Sure.
Which I raised last week. This using Ekron as Kasari,
yeah,
enables the Hamorim to go into this really beautiful juxtaposition of Jewish, as you say, Hashkafah viewpoint,
yeah,
versus the Gentile viewpoint. But the plain fact of the matter is, there was an Ekron that existed not far from Yerushalayim, not far from Ashdod or Eshkelon or Gath. Why doesn't anybody mention that? Why don't they come back and say, look, why are we talking about Kasari, which is 300 kilometers to the north? Why don't we just face the simple fact that you're wrong? I mean, the Ekron existed, and it actually exists today.
Okay.
And you can even see the tell of Ekron today as you go by.
Correct. Okay. All right. Let me state a couple of things, okay? Number one, remember that these drushes is what, it's in the realm of what we call Agada, okay?
Okay.
The realm of Agada is interested, particularly the aspect that we call Drash, is interested in drawing a lesson. And so therefore a pasuk is going to be interpreted not necessarily according to the Pshat, but it's going to be an interpretation in order to bring out a certain lesson. Okay? That's number one. Secondly, you're right. I mean that geographically, Ekron of the Philistines may not possibly be the same Ekron that they're talking about over here. But they're not interested in Ekron of the Philistines. They are interested in a symbolic Ekron. And who knows? Maybe the fact that there is a Kuf and a Resh over there reminded them of Kesaria. I don't know. It's a possibility. I don't know. It just falls into my head. It's far-fetched, I will say. But the point is that it is a symbol that they're interested in the symbolic Ekron, not in the actual Ekron. Okay? I mentioned just a few minutes before, if you remember, that I don't quite understand the chronology over here about where they identify that it was the Greeks. You know, Beit Hashmonai, and they fought against the Ivanim. It seems to me, you know, that that would be a period which is, of course, earlier than that of the Roman conquest of Eretz Yisrael, right? And it's quite possible that in this particular case, they did not want to offend, shall we say, the Roman authorities, so they made them into Greeks or something like that. It's possible, okay? You know, it happens even in modern literature today that if they're afraid of a government or something like that, they'll also change the name or something like that, okay? I remember, you know, in the 18th century English literature, if you recall, John Dryden wrote a satire called Absalom and Ahithophel, okay? In other words, Avshalom and Ahithophel, right? Okay. Now, in reality, he was referring to the England of his day and the monarchy and the nobility and so on and so forth. But he didn't want to be put under censorship, so he did that. Okay, so he used that. If you want to take a more recent case, take, for example, George Orwell, 1984. Right. So he was talking about the possibility of having, you know, a communist government in England, but, you know, he made it into an animal farm or something like that. Yeah, so, yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, so. Yes, you're absolutely right. Napoleon, it was banned over there.
Who would identify the two right. Napoleon and Snowball? I forget
the name. Right, Napoleon and Snowball, right? Yeah, okay. All right. So, anyway, getting back to our text over here. So, he says, in other words, don't believe that the two of them can exist at the same time and flourish together. This is what he says. One has to be up and the other one has to be down. Okay. Now he bases it, I have to tell you, upon a pasuk. Okay? And this is the pasuk now that he's going to quote. He says, Shenemar. We have a pasuk in Yechezkel where he pictures Tzor. Tzor, of course, is modern Tyre, okay? If you recall, there were two outstanding Phoenician cities. One was Tzor, and the other one was Sidon, okay? Which today we call Sidon, okay? Tyre and Sidon. Okay. Now, Tzor was a very, very prosperous city. You might consider it sort of like a city-state. Obviously, it was the leading place where the Phoenicians lived, the Canaan, okay? And it was famous as a great port. Remember, I mean, Phoenicians went on the Mediterranean from it, and they traveled, they settled in places in North Africa, and the Black Sea area, and God knows where else, you know, that they explored. Some even say that they came together with Jews to America, too. At least 1,000 or 2,000 years before Columbus or something like that, okay? So, at any rate, Yechezkel points Tzor, a city living in its tremendous pride in the power, the wealth that it possesses, okay? And what does he say? He has Tzor saying, Imola'o ha'chareva. If we take a look in the context of the pasuk, what Tyre is saying is, I am going to be full, literally. In other words, I'll be prosperous, right? Achareva, because she, meaning Yerushalayim, is destroyed. And so he says, what does it mean? So he says, Imbalaya zu charvazu. Right. If one of them is prosperous, then the other one is destroyed. Or Imalaya Zu Chorvazim, in other words, and if this one is prosperous, then it's another one. Either it's going to be the non-Jewish world or it's going to be the Jewish world. Okay, that's going to prosper. Okay. As I said, we don't have to accept all this as, you know, 100%. It's not halacha, okay? This is agada. But it gives you a picture as to the tremendous struggle that was going on in the Jewish soul 2,000 years ago, and we can see it reflected in the Jewish soul even to this day, which are the you know, what's the scale of values that we should adopt? How should we live? Should we adopt the values of the non-Jewish world? Should we adopt the values of the Jewish world? What should we do? Okay, so all of us who are gathered over here, I don't have to tell you, we have decided to make a synthesis of it. But I don't have to tell you. Assimilationists, they've left the values of Yiddishkeit altogether. They've left the Jews in many cases. They no longer identify themselves as Jews, okay? And on the other hand, of course, you have a group of people, you know, let's say in Beyashi Arim or something like that, who theoretically have nothing to do with the modern world. I say theoretically because it's impossible for the modern world not to penetrate Beyashi Arim and to have an effect. Kedem Kol, you go on Rechov Beyashi Arim, and what do you find? This one is selling you jewelry, and this one is selling you a Thomas bag, and this one is selling you tefillin, and so on. This one's selling you a pushka, snorkel boxes, and things like that. Okay. And there, as you go down the street, almost every few feet, you come to another store that's selling it. Now, obviously, they're not ignorant of the world. Not only that, but even though they like American money, but still, what? They're using Israeli money, right? They're still using Israeli money. They're still traveling up Egypt. And if, let's say, they refuse to have a television set in their home, as they do, okay, but many of them do listen to what? They listen to a radio. Many of them, like particularly, you know, today, there's a great many Jewish programs. When I say Jewish, I mean, you know, Chazonish, the Virabusa programs. You find that all kinds of small stations have arisen, illegal by Israeli standards, incidentally, because the establishment is anti-religious, I have to tell you, except for a few programs. But these have proliferated in the past few years, and you can hear Rabbanim talking and giving Musa, and you can hear all kinds of, you know, all the popular songs that they're playing over here in America. I mean, you know, this chazan and that one, and so on and so forth. They hear them over there in Israel too, okay? So, and also, there are newspapers, believe it or not, which cater to the very firm people. You have the Yateid Ne'aman, for example. You have the Aguda paper, what is it called again? I forget for a moment the paper. Huh? Not so fast. Mizrahi paper. That's Mizrahi, right. For the moment, the name escapes me, but that's all right. Take my word for it. People are reading them, even though they are Haredim, right? And they're aware of the fact what Bush is up to, right? And what Sharon is up to, and things like that, and so on. They're not ignorant of the modern world. This is why I say, well, in theory, we may think that all that they do is simply stay within the dalet amos, as we would say, of the yeshiva and the home, and never go out except for that, right? But in reality, they are aware of what's going on.
Yeah, but how about them? Which set of values is going to prevail?
Well, among them, obviously, the Jewish set of values is going to prevail.
The set of values, these are customs and
right,
actions, but
right,
the set of
right.
values on either side is
yeah.
Many ways that they, no matter which one, because we see it.
Yeah.
The Christian world.
Right, the question is, which is going to outweigh the other one? This is what it boils down to.
But which one is
right.
still going to come up with a set of values?
Yeah, right. Okay, so it's either Yerushalayim, or it's the non-Jewish world. This is what he says, okay? Rab Nachman bar Yitzchak omar mehocha. He says, I don't need, you know, to take a pasuk that's a little bit difficult to understand. He said, I have a simple one. We have a pasuk in the Torah. It says, of course, this, if you remember, is when Rivka became pregnant with her twins, right? She didn't know why she was having such a difficult pregnancy. And what happened? So it's written over there about Telech L'Droshes Chalakim, right? That she went in order to inquire of Hashem, right? Naturally, where did she go? So according to Medrash, she went to the yeshiva of Shem V'Ever, okay? That's the first yeshiva, okay? So she went over there, and then it's written, of course, by Yom Hashem Lo, Hashem said unto her, Shnei Goyim Evitnech, right? There are two nations actually within your womb, Shnei Yomim Meyachi Paredo, two nations will, you know, will be born of you, Ula'om Nila'om Ye'emat, and one nation will be stronger than the other, right? And then after that it says, for Rav the Abot, so yeah, the older one will serve the younger one. Well, that is not always the Mekuyim, as we say. But at any rate, Ula'om Nila'om Ye'emat indicates that already there is also a clash, even before Yaakov and Esav were born, there were already two different personalities, and the two of them, you know, after they were born, they had difficulty in coexisting. Okay. All right. The Omer Rabbi Yitzchak. Okay. Here's another statement made by Rabbi Yitzchak to follow upon some of those that have been made before. It says, "My Dechsin says, what is the meaning of a pasuk? And this is a pasuk that comes from Yeshayahu. It says, Yuchan Rasha, the Rasha is to be pitied, so to speak. Yuchan, literally, grace should be shown to the Rasha. Okay? Balabat Tzedek, because he has not learned righteousness. So, Oma Yitzchak of the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, Yitzchak said to the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he said, Rabbeinu Shalom, says, Yuchan Esav, please, let Esav be, you know,